Thank you. Thank you very much for introducing me. Thank you, Hot Grove, for the invitation to come and address you guys. But I'd like to start off with Mr. Martin Lakrantzi. You're a true patriot. You know, wherever you go for the last 3 years, people talk about a failed state. Negative mindsets, no hope, leaving the country, what's going to happen to our children, what's the future like, all those kind of things. When to come with a positive mindset like that, that's the beginning of change. So let's start at that point. Challenges are nothing new. It's something that we go through from small, whether it's in a preschool, a primary school with bullies, a high school with a teacher that's complicated, and when you go to universities. In universities, you're thrown in the deep end. It's not like school. The teacher's not there to guide you. The lecturer gives you a few notes on the board, and you've got to find your own way. And then you go into companies, and you have challenges there. How do you deal with the challenges? That's the issue. Challenges will always be there. It's a fact of life. Husband and wife, parents and children, and today the children are absolutely complicated. You're talking about grandchildren. Today's grandchildren, the age of 3, got a mind of their own. I know I've got 9 grandchildren. Each one is a monster more than the other one. So these are a fact of life. But if you guys remember, in the 70s with the Middle East War, we had a fuel crisis. You could only buy, I think, 5 liters or 10 liters of fuel and keep it at home. We overcame that. In 2008, in 2009, we had the banking crisis worldwide. South Africa survived that. The interest rate at one point went to 24%. We've survived that. 2018, Cape Town went to day zero, and you had only 50 liters of water per day, and we survived that. In 2020 came the COVID. We lost 2 million jobs, of which we got them back, and we lost 100,000 people. Not much you can do about that, but we've come out of that. In 2021, we had a civil unrest in KZN, and we've recovered, and so a story on its own. 2022, massive floods in KZN. Infrastructure damage, loss of life, big challenges to KZN. We had floods in 2019, COVID in 20, civil unrest in 21, floods in 22, and we survived that. 23 and 24, we're suffering with E. coli in the water, and of course, the whole of last year was load shedding. So these are all negative things in front of you. But how do you deal with it? You see, all of you can be fit, and you can train, and you can exercise, and you can do all those kind of things. But if you have a negative mindset, a negative mind will destroy your entire body. There's only 2 things that give you a positive mindset and hope, and that is faith and spirituality. There is no other way, whether you believe or not, it's not being imposed on you. But there's no other way where you can see positivity and hope besides having faith and spirituality. That's the source of mindset change. You see, 2 years ago, our trucks went up into Queenstown, Komani. And it's around 5 o'clock in winter, it's dark. An old lady comes out of the house from the rural area. She sees the truck. Everybody knows our branding, everybody knows our color is green, everybody knows who we are. And as the truck came up the village, when she came out of her house, she looked at it. She was on her crutches, she picks her hands up, and she looks heavenwards, and she says, "You never let me down." What's the implication of that? You see, she never called us. She never called me. She never called my Eastern Cape team members. She didn't call anybody in the organization, but she called on God himself. And this truck arrived in the area, not knowing why we went there. And she gratefully took that food parcel, and her faith was substantially increased. In 2005, I was in Pakistan. Massive earthquake. I normally carry my phones with me, but as I was getting to the truck, I told my friend, my team member, to hold the phones. And then he walked a few meters away to check something, and the truck driver drove off. But we were in a convoy, so that was fine. But we reached a certain point in the convoy where this truck driver went off on his own, and the other trucks went in another direction. So I had no communications, no cell phone, no money, no network, and nobody to talk to. And I don't speak the language. Another truck driver was driving somewhere else. And suddenly I realized I was not lost. I was taken to a community that was lost. Because on the roadside, I saw a whole lot of people. Young children, old people, middle people, no food, no covering. It was freezing cold in Pakistan, October 2005. And when I saw all this on the road, I realized God himself had directed me there. I couldn't speak the language, so I just said, he understood, I got to stop now. As he stopped, I took out the stuff and the people helped me. You see, in disasters, you don't need words. You see it in the eyes. And you could see the faith and the hope and the gratitude in those eyes. When those children received the blankets, the mattresses, the warm clothes, the food items, and there was great gratitude when that happened. In the rush, after we offloaded, the driver drove off without me. I'm in a country that I don't speak the language. There's no GPS. There's no phones. I don't know which way to walk. If I go up, I may end up in Afghanistan. If I go to the right, I'll end up in India. If I go to the left, I may go in the sea. And if I go to the south, maybe I'll go to Karachi. I don't know which direction to go. So I just focused on my inner being and said, God, this is your job. The next minute, the moon comes out and the light shines in front of me. It was the only light. It was pitch black. So I followed the light of the moon. Not sure where I was going. But the moonlight brought me exactly into the camp where I left from. But no GPS, no direction, and the Pakistani army was in a frenzy. They said, do you know where you went? I said, I got lost. They said, you went to the area where all the kidnappers are. You people disappear there. I said, nobody said anything. I just walked and I came. They looked at me like I was some kind of mad guy. They couldn't believe that I came out of that area. It's about faith and spirituality. January 20th, 2010, 8 days into the earthquake in Haiti, in the collapsed Catholic Church, my team started getting sounds. And 3 hours later, they pulled out alive 64-year-old Enazizi. No oxygen, no food, no water, fractured hip, completely covered in rubble. When they pulled her out, her first words to my team was, I love God Almighty. You instilled hope and faith in somebody several thousand kilometers away. But it was her own faith and her own spirituality that kept her alive. There was no hope in hell of anybody finding somebody 8 days later. But she kept that faith. And the second words were, I love you. The essence of faith and spirituality is service. It's what people are doing in Senegal. When you start helping each other, you start making progress. You see, we need to stop complaining. And we need to go back and understand how fortunate we are. Sorry, I'm a very blunt guy. So just take it as it happens. 27 April 1994 is the greatest day in the history of this country. Why? Not because the black government replaced the white government. No, that's not important. Governments come and go all the time. That's not a big deal. What was important is what happened on that day. You see, the world's media came here with the war room. Why do you come with the war room? They came to film mayhem, chaos, burning, destruction, violence, looting, white people being thrown into the sea. That's what they came for. Because world media loves sensationalism. What happened? It was the most boring day in world history. Nothing happened. But in nothing that happened, everything happened. Why? What am I referring to? You see the masses. They didn't say it. The body language book. We're a people of faith. We won't destroy. We won't take revenge. We don't want vengeance. We want to hold hands. We'll build together. But the wound was very deep. They know what happened on June 16. They know what happened on March 21. They know about the Cradock 4. They know about Kufut. They know about CCB. They know about Boss. They know about Solomon Mashlangu. They know about Imam Harun. They know about detention without trial. They know about torture and apartheid and injustice. But they didn't say it. But we embrace and hold hands together. That to me, ladies and gentlemen, is the greatest salvage of this country. I know. I'm not a normal tourist. I'm a disaster tourist. I go to the worst places on earth with my teams, where there's mayhem, chaos, confusion, disorder, killing, murder, and every type of disorder, every type of evil that you can see in people, we see all over. I'm doing this for 32 years. That's all I do. Monday to Sunday, 365 days a year. And 2 years before that, I'm a disaster specialist. And I see all kinds of chaos and mayhem. It never happened here. Count your lucky stars. You can't fix that. Pothole you can fix. Load shedding you can fix. Water you can fix. You're already fixing it there in Senegal. Things you can fix. That you can't fix. Something else happened. When Mandela came out, he embraced his jailer. He formed a government of national unity. And he said, no vindictiveness. He put this stem in Kosi Sikelela. Show me one political party in the world that will take the national anthem of a people they replace and put in the new anthem. Show me one in the world, 204 countries. You won't find it. Short compromise for reconciliation. And then the following year, he did the unthinkable. He wore Francois Pienaar's number 6 jersey for the Rugby World Cup. Great challenge within his party. They were not happy. They were very unhappy, actually, about why he did that. But he was a statesman. He understood that on 27 April 94, the country could have burnt. They would have won every battle, but they would have lost the war. Nobody survives when you have civil unrest, friction, killing, mayhem, and disorder. So he compromised and he wore that jersey. Please tell me how logical and how possible it is for people who had hundreds of years of colonialism and apartheid from 1948 to have a black population supporting a white rugby team in 1 year. How is that possible? It's because people are people of faith and spirituality. That's the greatest grace of this country. Nurture that. And what Mr. Khansi is saying is right. We need to help each other. There is no other way of fixing this country. We are in the common habit of saying it's the government's responsibility. If I take this country and offer it to America, to Canada, to Germany, to France, anybody in Europe, Australia, say take it for free. They will tell me, are you mad? How can 7.4 million people's taxes look after 65 million people? Can you do it, any of your corporates? It's not possible. No matter which political party runs the country, it's not possible. And remember, most of the 65 million people were disadvantaged pre-94. We never gave them a chance to study, to get a degree, to be a professional, to do entrepreneurship. But they sat patiently and quietly and not making any disturbance. We need to understand that. The difficulties that people go through. In your own companies, can all of you put solar panels? Can you put new equipment? Will the bank give you a loan easily? No. Government doesn't have the wherewithal to fix everything for 7.4 million people's taxes. It's just not possible. Yes, they are responsible for corruption. They're responsible for state capture. They're responsible for giving tender to their friends. They have to account for that. They're responsible for mismanagement. But a lot of the corruption has been started by the private sector. Who corrupts government? Did they do it themselves? Who gives incentives? Who overinflates prices? Who had price fixing on the stadiums, on bread price, on other supplies in the country? Overinflated prices. Who does that? We are equally responsible. It's human nature to be greedy. And then you destroy everything. Government is bad. Government is not corrupt. There are corrupt people in government. It's very different from saying government is corrupt. You have government corrupt people in the corporates, in my sector, in the church sector, in the mosque, in the religious sector, in sports. We have corrupt people everywhere. We have to change our own internal being. Four qualities are critical. You want to fix this country? You don't need money. You need four important qualities. Spirituality, morality, values, and ethics. And fortunately, a lot of companies are now creating ethical section where ethics are part of the company. And when you have that and you go back to the church and the school and the mosque and the temple and the synagogue and you start bringing values like to our new generation, we will have those values that will make us accountable to ourselves. We won't do anything dishonest. So we have come from a very dark past, but we are very fortunate with what has happened from 94 to now. You see, again, we've got to think positively. We say load shedding. Worst case scenario, 10 hours gone. Yes, 10 hours gone. But 14 hours, you did have electricity, didn't you? 5 o'clock, the wife will say, I have to go home. I've got to bathe the baby, take the hot water, cook the food, do the dishwashers, and the washing machine. And we, South Africans, we adapt. We are a very adaptable nation. In Europe, if it's 1 hour load shedding, it's time to die. They can't cope with that kind of stuff. We are very philosophical. Okay, the lights are off. At some point, even the lights are on, we think it's still off. We can't put it on, put a switch on. We don't know. Because we're so used to it to live in that kind of condition. We are a nation like that. That we adapt because we all come from different faith groups. You have your Sunday school, you have your churches, you have your priests, you have all that kind of stuff. That is our greatest value. Our faith and positivity. Apply it in your daily life and count the favors and the blessings that you have. I've come back from Yemen last year. We ran probably the biggest operation in the country from outside. Because of the internal war, there are areas where there is zero electricity. So the hospitals, the dialysis machines, the ICU, the water pumps can't function. If you go drive through Aden or Sana'a or Hudaydah or Taiz, you'll see hundreds of buildings incomplete. No economy. But the people walk around smiling. They have hope that one day the situation will change. We need to understand gratitude. We need to be grateful. And initiatives like what's happening in Senegal, it's what needs to be happening all over South Africa. If I take all of us, and take the government, and take the political parties, and take all the corporates, and take all the religious leaders, and the police, and the defense force, and the sports people, and the NGOs, and the communities, and the CPFs, give them the same uniform, black, white, green, whatever you want to wear, and put them all in one stadium. You won't know who. No branding, no badge, no title, no name, nobody. Just all in the stadium. You won't know who is who. But what you will know, that everybody in the stadium is a South African. And what you will know, that no matter where you're from, we all have the same needs and the same wants. We want peace, security, education, health, water, food, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, the opportunity to grow, develop. We all want that. Now take a whole lot of problems and throw it into the stadium. How are you going to solve it? Are all of us going to run through different exits, run away from the problem? Or we'll all go towards each other. And the most skilled people will deal with the problem in the most appropriate way. This is what's happening in Senegal. That when we move towards each other, we have no ego issues, no race, no color, no religion. The only concept we have is humanity. That what I want for me, I want for you. That's the religious teaching. It's in your books. It's in all our books. That what I want for you, for me, I want for you also. And the moment you have that kind of positive mindset, you can fix anything. So I come back to the beginning. It's not about the challenge. They're not going to go away. They're going to keep coming. But they're not going to stop. In our books, there's God's promise. I've created man into toil and struggle and shown him the two highways. But he had made no haste on the path that is steep. The part that's difficult, the one that's full of challenges. You don't want to take it on. I will keep giving it to you to test your faith. The challenges will keep coming. How positive will we remain? How will we respond? Seneca is a brilliant example of how we need to respond. I'll give you one example. You mentioned the floods last year. In Citrus Dal, when the floods came last year, people were cut off for 7 days. The wind was too strong. The rain was too harsh. The roads were gone. The bridges were gone. People were stuck. You couldn't get inside. Women, men, children, all were hungry. The ATM couldn't work. There was no money. Goods couldn't come in. You couldn't buy. Even if you had money in the house, you couldn't get stuff because trucks couldn't go across. People were stranded no matter what status you are, high class, middle class, low class. You're all caught up in the same boat, like the stadium story. What do you do? So we drove there with our trucks. Government, national and provincial, divers, helicopter pilots, disaster management, municipality, paramedics, ambulance services, and farmers with our teams, and engineers. So we said, look, this bridge we can't cross. So somebody asked, is there like another option? So a farmer driving the area said, I know that farmer, that side, 8 to 10 kilometers down the road, who's got a small bridge that can cross from another side. This is working together. So the trucks and the buckies and the police and everybody went to this farm's place. We found the bridge. The water was still running across. And we said, oops, are we going to go across this bridge? So the engineer said, we think it will hold. Not too sure. My drivers had to make the decision. Will they drive across that bridge? I can't impose on them, it's their life. The divers very happily said, we'll get into the water. If you fall in, we'll take you out. So the drivers looked at this, and the first guy said to me, I'm going to drive. And as he went across the bridge, the divers were waiting. The farmer said, around, engineers around, and he crossed. And the second truck crossed. And the buckets came, and everybody came. And as we drove into Citrus Dal, the jubilation, the joy, the thankfulness, the gratitude, that food, blankets, tents, water, bottled water, sanitary pads, diapers, fruit, and everything came. You see, when you stand together and you have faith, you can do that in Citrus Dal. We did it in McGregor. We've done it in PE. We've done it in other parts, in Kuruman, in all parts of the country. We've done lots of things. We did it in George with the building collapse recently, all working together. When you have no ego and the desire to work together, you can fix anything. And that's the attitude we need to have. We've proven it over and over again. Let me give you the story of P. They called us in May 2022, reaching day zero. We drilled 50 boreholes in the city, in very strategic locations, to prevent civil unrest and to help them. Now today we got floods there. In the same year, in December 2022, a massive fire hit PE. The fire chief calls, acting fire chief, he calls and he says, number one, my trucks can't reach the fire. Number two, I don't have enough fire people. Number three, I don't have water to fill the trucks. Number four, I don't have water, energy foods, energy drinks to give the fire people. I said, you're in deep shit. Your city is going to burn because they can't get to the fire. The only way is to drop the thing from the top. No other way. We brought in 2 helicopters from George, 2 planes from Stellenbosch. We brought in additional firefighters, brought in the energy drinks and the biscuits, brought in our own water tankers, supported those water tankers, opened up all our boreholes, and all the Africana people, you guys are very good at handyman work, came with your buckies and your JoJo tanks, and we loaded all of that stuff. And everybody took responsibility of burning the fire. You could have sat back and said, the municipality's responsibility. Whilst waiting for the municipality, you also would have burnt if you took a negative approach. And within 5 days, we brought that entire fire to a standstill. We stopped it. The helicopters were coming, just turning all the time, and the planes. When we walked into the mall, A lady came and touched me and started sobbing. So I said, what happened? She said, my house was about to burn and your helicopter came past and threw the water on the fire. My house got saved. The mall on end to which they wanted to sell, I think they sold already. The fire was right at the mall and the helicopters came and just stopped the fire at the right time. We didn't see whose house, whose mall, whose shop, whose land, whose house. We just did it. A city got saved, jobs got saved, lives got saved, development took place. Hive wants to invest 100 billion rand into PE for ammonium hydroxide, hydrogen energy. When you do good things come back to you. So let me go back to the beginning and then I'll finish off. You see, everybody knows that the gift of the givers was formed on 6 August 1992. That's the physical material date. To me, it goes back way beyond. I'm much older now. I can reflect, I can think, I'm more mature, I've got more reason. And I sit back and think on my life. I say, no, this thing happened in 1985, not in 92. In 1980, my mother had passed on in 1984. I'm born in Potchefstroom. My mother and my father got separated. I moved to Durban in 74. I finished matric there. I did medical school there. And in 84, my mother passed on. And in 85, I was doing internship in King Edward Hospital. Now, when you're young, everybody, we have aspirations. So I said, I'm going to finish an internship. I'm going to be a medical officer, a registrar, and I'm going to become a specialist in internal medicine. I want to be a specialist physician. 1986, no opportunity, no post, couldn't study further. I had two choices, much like what everybody in the country is being faced with now. I could sit in the corner and cry and mope and wail and say, I'm depressed, it's the end of the world. Or I can say, fate has another opportunity for me. I need to do something different. We have a teaching. We don't pray for what we want. We pray for what is good for us. Because what you want may not necessarily be good for you. So, in January 86, I moved to Peter Maritzburg, opened a private practice. The week I get there, an Afrikaner guy from Pretoria comes there. My butcher, I got a new building, I got all new neighbors. So my new neighbor was a butcher, comes down and said, this guy came from Pretoria, he bought meat from me, he needs a doctor. So I meet Miller, and I treat him. And then one day he tells me, I want you, you've treated me for quite some time now. I want to tell you, share a story with you. He says, before I came from Pretoria, I was in New York. I went on a scholarship. And one day, whilst I was walking the streets of New York, I was dejected, depressed, broken, hopeless, loss of everything. And my soul felt empty, my spirit felt empty. I don't even know why the hell I was in New York. I was so down. From the corner of my eye, it's what people have been feeling everywhere in the world. He said, from the corner of my eye, I see a man looking at me. I don't know this man. I've never seen him before. But my heart tells me, follow this man. We have a teaching that whenever you are lost or confused or don't know what to do, listen to your heart, not your head. So he follows the man. And the man walks into St. John the Divine. It's a huge church in New York. I've been there on my way to Haiti. He said, but when I walked into the church, I got a shock. The man I was following was a Muslim, a Turk, a Sufi master, a master of spirituality. And he said, in the church, suddenly, this man started making a zikr. A zikr in Islamic terminology and Islamic tradition is a celebration of God's names in Arabic. So in English, you would say God, the one and only, kind, compassionate, merciful, eternal, loving, absolute, cherisher, nourisher, sustainer, and so it goes. He said, when he started doing it in the church, there were other Muslims in the church. There were Jews. There were Christians from different denominations. There were Hindus, and there were people who said, we don't believe in anything. But they all participated in the zikr. I said, oh, are you sure? He said, I was there. I saw it in my own eyes. And then it struck me. I said, but the world always said that religion is the cause of conflict. No. Religion is not the cause of conflict. It's people who move away from religion that cause the conflict. Because those people in the church, the elders of the church, understood the unity of religion. They understood the unity of mankind. They had no issue what a Muslim practice taking place in the church. And there's one church in Cape Town that does this here in South Africa. It's called St. George's Cathedral, where Jews, Christians, and Muslims all can pray in a church. Father Michael Wieder. It's happened not once, hundreds of times. Because people have understood this togetherness. When we remove our barriers, fixing the country is about removing barriers, about understanding each other as humanity. He then tells me, "You need to go to Turkey." I said, "Miller, I know you're not feeling well. It's 1986. I haven't even seen Cape Town yet. When am I going to get to Turkey?" He said something very profound. And it's a theme that I keep repeating. He said, "What God wills happens. There's a time and a place." 91 August, my wife and I landed up in Turkey. It's a long story. And I went again, 6th August, 1992. What Miller saw in New York, I saw in Istanbul. What he saw in a church, I saw in a Sufi place, an Islamic place in Turkey. When I walked in, Jews, Christians, Hindus, Americans, Russians, people from Canada, North America, parts of America, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, New Zealand, Australia, parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, Germany, France, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, all mixed from different religions and different nationalities. No friction, no discord, respect for each other. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I understand there is hope for this world because we've done incredible things in this world, in science and technology, but we still haven't learned how to live with each other. And we need to prevent that from happening in this country. We wanted to build into a fantastic, stable state. That night at 10 p.m., the spiritual teacher, after zikr, now you won't understand what I'm telling you. You know, when you do a zikr, you feel the presence of God Almighty right with you. And in that presence, the spiritual teacher lifts his eye up, makes eye contact with me, and he looks heavenward at the same time. So he's looking at me, and he's not looking at me. In fluent Turkish, and I don't speak a word of Turkish, but in fluent Turkish, I understood every word that he said in Turkish that night. He said, "My son, I'm not asking you. I'm instructing you to form an organization." He gave the name. He said, "The name in Arabic will be Waqful Waqifin." Translated, it's not exactly correct, but translated, "Gift of the Givers." You will serve all people of all races, all religions, all colors, all classes, all cultures, of any geographical location and of any political affiliation. But you will serve them unconditionally. When we do this kind of work in Senegal and everywhere else, don't expect anything in return. You will serve them unconditionally. You don't expect anything in return, not even a thank you. This is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. I was 30 years old. He said, "My son, serve people with love, kindness, compassion, and mercy. And remember, the dignity of man is foremost. Stop worrying about potholes and water and food and roads and management and engineering. When people's dignity is gone, keep your passport ready. Keep your shoe ready, straight to the airport. Because that's the day the country will burn. When people lose their dignity, there is no hope. There is no future. There is no accountability. There is no sense or there is no degree of what disaster will happen because people have no more, nothing left. And when there's no hope, there is just no, the circumstances will be a total disaster. And by doing things like what you're doing in Senegal and what we need to do all over the country, when you give people dignity, when you give them hope, when you give them support, you change their mindset. And that's the most crucial thing to remember. When you qualified, did you get a job same time? What's it like walking around without a job, being alone, feeling lack of self-esteem? We need to create jobs for children, for young people. Give them a stipend even if it's 2,000 men. Give them some kind of a job. Write it off your tax expense. You give them self-esteem. You give them hope, you give them thought processes, you give them experience. They move away from all kinds of crime and difficulty. One person for 2,000 men will look after his family of seven. The social impact in the country will improve. All of us, I'm sure we can do something like that. Clothe the naked, feed the hungry, provide water to the thirsty. And in everything that you do, be the best at what you do. No second grade, the best. Why? He said, be the best, not because of ego, but because you're dealing with human life, human suffering, human dignity, and human life. And then I asked him, oh, he said something very important. He said, my son, remember that whatever you do is done through you and not by you. No place for ego. Everything that all of you think that I do is not humanly possible. I asked him, how come when you speak Turkish, I understand, and other people speak Turkish, I don't understand? He said, my son, when the hearts connect and the souls connect, the words become understandable. I asked him, what exactly am I supposed to do? He told me one line. You will know. I said, I will know what? The moment I walked out of that place on 6 August 1992, it came to me, respond to the civil war in Bosnia. That same month, not 10 months later, that same month, I took in 32 containers of aid into a war zone all alone. November the same year, I took in another 8 containers of winter items. And the following year, we designed the world's first containerized mobile hospital. A world first, a product of South African technology and South African engineering. Ourselves and Alfred van der Wetering Engineering, Johan and Gert van der Wetering, we sat together and we designed this container. A container hospital built in Africa, taken from Africa into Europe. That was in 93. We need to believe in ourselves. We got the skill to compassion and to do things in the right way. When CNN filmed the hospital on 1st February 94, they said the South African containerized mobile hospital is equal to any of the best hospitals in Europe. I want to finish off with two more stories related to that and one more story. I'll be finished in 3 minutes, don't worry. I still got 3 minutes. You see, let's bring it more forward. January 6, 2014, we got a call from Al-Qaeda in Yemen. They said, are you the guys looking for 2 South African hostages? We said, yes, that's what we've been seeing from May last year. They said, come tomorrow, 10 o'clock, 7 January to Aden. Come alone. My team member goes, speaks the language. I'm not there. Our foreigners can't go. He goes, we don't know who it was that took Yolandi and Pierre Koki. So he walks in, 10 o'clock. He says, they tell him, do you know who we are? We are Al-Qaeda. You know what we're capable of. What do you want? He said, I came for the man and the woman, South African. Fine, let's talk about the woman first. You can have her, $3 million. So they allowed him to talk to me. I said, tell him no money, sorry. We started discussing with them. Neither he nor me are trained in hostage negotiations. No university degree, no honors, no masters, no PhD. No hostage negotiator in the world trained us. No intelligence service, no security agency trained us. In 3 days, from January 7th to January 10th, in 3 days, understanding their body language, their mind, him on WhatsApp to me, and I'm talking to him. Together, we pulled out Yolandi Koki alive. Unconditional, no ransom in 3 days, but no training. We just knew exactly what to do. No government, no agency, no negotiator in the world has done that ever. And we did it in 3 days. Because the teacher said, you will know what to do. The final story, November last 2022, I got a call from Cape Town and my friend says, do you want to meet the new general manager of Turkish Airlines? He's coming from San Francisco to Cape Town. I said, yes, in my business, I got to know everybody and disasters. So he says, I said, but I won't meet him now. I'll meet him when the time is right. February 1st, 2023. I'm on the plane in Durban. I'm about to fly. And the thought comes to me, you better call the guy now. There's no book. There's no records. There's no notes. The thought just comes to your head. So I phoned him. I said, this guy's here. He said, I'll call you back in 2 minutes. Calls me back. He said, 9:30, supper, Saray, restaurant near the waterfront. I get off the plane. I go straight to the supper. His name is Muhammad Ona. I said, Muhammad, tell me, I need an airline partner. In the event an earthquake hits a country, I need to move search and rescue teams, medical teams, dog handlers, dogs, medical equipment, search and rescue equipment, and supplies, tents, blankets, food, medicine, and so forth. Can it be done speedily? Because the faster you get there, the faster you save lives. He said, done. 5 days later, 4:10 a.m., 6 February, the earthquake hits his country. What's the chance of that being a coincidence? 24 hours, your team's on the plane. We reach Istanbul. You don't tell the government where you want to go. They tell you where you must go. 172 countries responded, somewhat more than one team. Say, let's say an average of 300 teams arrived. That's very important to understand this. Only 12 teams were sent to Hatay, and I was in Hatay in November 2022. Hatay was 95.9% wiped out from the face of the earth. Only 12 teams were selected to go to Hatay. Two Chinese, two Turkish, Italian, Jordanian, Omani, Saudi, Croatian, Serbian, Bosnian, and South African. 12 teams only out of 300 teams were selected to go to Hatay. On day 8, we were the only guys that had 5 dogs. Nobody had 5 dogs. And somebody came to us, other teams came to us, can we lend, borrow your dog? Because I'm an Indian, $50 an hour. Any case, on day 8, the dog says, go to that building. And we pull out alive a 90-year-old granny from the building that the dog went. And finally, the last point. The Bosnian team leader comes to us, touches my team leader on the shoulder, and he starts crying. And we ask him, like, what happened? He takes out a wallet, takes out a picture from the wallet, and in the picture, there's a baby and a woman. He said, that baby, that's me. That lady, that's my mother. We know your guy's name. That's what do you mean? He said, 30 years ago, in 1993, I was born in the hospital that Gift of the Givers brought to Bosnia. 172 countries, 300 teams, 12 teams go to Hatay. One is Bosnian, one is South African, and the team leader of the Bosnian team was born in that hospital. Faith and spirituality, positivity and hope, working together, no ego. We will fix this country. This is the greatest country on earth. While they told you how many are leaving, did they tell you that 400,000 people came back and that many more want to come back? Be positive. Let's work together. We can fix this country. Thank you very much.